on redistricting. Thank you, Senator Bach, for your punctuality. And thank you, Mr. Gillespie, for joining us. And as we noted at the front end of this, we have the state budget forecast today and some briefings associated with that. So it's going to be hard to go beyond 9:30, and I know Mr. Gillespie is prepared to deal within those time constraints. We will have members filtering in and out, but let's kick it off here. Mr. Gillespie, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration. I've been asked to put together some briefing materials on population change as it affects apportionment and redistricting within the state. Just looking first just at the overall picture, Minnesota added nearly 350,000 people last decade for 7.8% overall growth over the decade. Our population is now about 5.3 million people. Minnesota and South Dakota, like as has been the norm since World War II, shared the lead for being the fastest growing of the Frost Belt states in the Midwest and Northeast portions of the United States. I hate to say it, but South Dakota just barely edged us out in percentage population growth, but of course we beat them in numeric population growth. South Dakota grew by 7.9% compared to our 7.8% over the decade. Minnesota ranked 26th in percent change among states, putting us right in the middle of all the states in the country, and 21st in numeric change. Texas added the most number of people, adding more than 4 million people during the decade, and Nevada added about 35% to their population to lead the nation in total percent growth. One other additional item for that will become important for the redistricting process is that in Minnesota, the majority of our population growth was attributable to growth in populations of color, our minority populations, accounting for about 65% of the total growth in Minnesota during the first 9 years of the decade. The minority populations of Minnesota now comprise approximately 15% of the total population of the state. Not surprising in a pattern that has been set up since World War II is that most of the growth in the United States occurred in the southwest and west portions of the country and in the southeast portions of the country. We did actually exceed the growth rate of a few of the Sun Belt states like Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana, but by and large, the states in the southwest and southeast portions of the country, the Sun Belt, have experienced the greatest population growth.
And excuse me, Mr. Gillespie, is that back on that map? I don't have my cheaters on today, but is that Michigan that is actually dropping dropping the most?
Mr. Chair, Michigan declined in population just slightly, about 0.6% over the decade. North Dakota started off declining in population, but its growth began to pick up towards the end of the decade and is now growing and experiencing some resurgence. Louisiana also had episodes during the decade of population loss and ended up the decade with a very slight gain, but has still not really fully recovered from, or at least portions have not fully recovered from the Katrina hurricane. Looking at states of similar size, Colorado is coming up fast on our heels. Last decade, they grew by nearly 17%. They now have 7 congressional seats. Alabama is the next down, but we're still growing a bit faster than Alabama, and so we should be able to stay ahead of them. We are also catching Wisconsin up. Wisconsin grew by about 6% and to our 7.8%, so we are catching up on Wisconsin. If we look at county change around the country, There is a pattern that is important for Minnesota that is persistent throughout the United States and persistent over a long period of time. Is a very large number of counties, in the particular of rural counties, but especially in the prairie areas, the plains areas of the nation, in the heartland of the nation. Many of the counties have been declining in population and have been declining for a long period of time, some of which are, an increasing number of which are experiencing natural decrease, where in a normal year they have more people die than are born, which is a fairly unusual circumstance. It's not because they're unhealthy, it's just that they're very old populations and they have very few people of childbearing years. That is generally true for the Dakotas and for Nebraska, Kansas, eastern Colorado, much of Montana, parts of Wyoming, Oklahoma, and North Texas. The western and southwestern corner of Minnesota also fits that pattern, and is a very consistent pattern over time. We see other similar areas of the country, just not as large, in the Mississippi, southern Mississippi River Valley, and then also in Appalachia, have many of the counties have experienced long-term population loss. And this shows up when we focus in on Minnesota, that many of the counties in southern and southwestern and northwestern Minnesota have declined in population. Most of our population growth occurred around the Twin Cities in an axis from about St. Cloud through the Twin Cities to Rochester, with a spur down towards Mankato. The central cities and interior suburbs experienced either population decline or very little change in population. Most of the growth occurred outside of the Beltway in the traditional suburban counties and in the exurban counties surrounding the Twin City metropolitan area. This chart also reinforces that over the last decade, Minneapolis experienced a very slight gain in population. St. Paul, essentially no change. Most of the growth occurred in counties such as Sherburne, Wright, Isanti, and Chisago counties. Carver and Scott were also very rapidly growing counties. And for much of the decade, those counties those 6 counties were in the top 100 fastest growing counties of the country and experiencing extremely rapid rates of growth. Anoka, Dakota, and Washington counties also experienced growth, but not quite to the same degree. And similarly, most of our minority population growth occurred in the central city and suburban counties of Minnesota. But we do have, in terms of percent minority, a couple counties outside of the metropolitan area that have very high proportions of minority people, including Monoman County and also Nobles County in southwestern Minnesota.
And Mr. Gillespie, on that point, so in some of these counties that are kind of new to this particular chart, is there a particular city where that minority population is showing up in those particular counties, Monoman, Nobles, Beltrami?
Mr. Chair, of course, in Beltrami County, Bemidji is an important city. In Beltrami and Manoman, the proportions of minority people largely related to the presence of very large American Indian reservations, and have long had fairly high proportions of minority people. In Nobles County in southwestern Minnesota, the focus is in Worthington, in the city of Worthington, and is largely related to the presence of food processing plants and the demand for labor that was brought in. That is a pattern that also shows up in isolated areas, generally not in total populations of counties, but in isolated areas around the state in rural Minnesota, as well as rural Iowa and other Midwestern states where large meatpacking plants were built, particularly in the early 90s, and when that industry vertically integrated.
I am Mr. Gillespie. Senator Senjum with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to that state map? Just I think it's one back. There, in the area what I would call from southern Minnesota the Red Lake area. Is there anything up there? What is that? The Thief River Falls area, or what's significant up there in terms of causing that degree of population growth? Do you have any thoughts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, in the Beltrami area, Bemidji continues to grow. They've had growth in the university in Bemidji. They've also had continued growth in the reservation populations and also in some resort aspects of the growth. There is that continues to be a growth area. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The pulling much of this information together, once a decade, the U.S. House of Representatives is reapportioned according to constitutional specifications, based upon the total populations of the state in a formula that has been in existence since the early 40s. The net effect this time was, well, Minnesota kept our 8 seats. I'll say a little bit more about that in just a moment. Iowa lost a seat this time. Wisconsin lost a seat last time. Michigan and Illinois each lost a seat, as did Missouri. Ohio and New York lost 2 seats each, and Pennsylvania and New Jersey also lost, along with Massachusetts. The big gainer this time was Texas, gaining 4 seats, and followed by Florida with a gain of 2 congressional seats. The only Sun Belt state that lost a congressional seat this time was Louisiana, and that has an interesting history in relationship to Minnesota. That during the 1980s, when Minnesota was experiencing, particularly in the first half of the 80s, very slow population growth and a lot of economic problems, Louisiana was enjoying a very strong oil industry, and it appeared that Louisiana would pass us in population. Towards the end of the decade, the oil industry really hit the skids, and Minnesota's growth greatly accelerated. At the end of the decade, we kept our 8 seats, and that continued on through the 90s, and this time we continue to keep our 8 seats in Louisiana. It's now fallen back to 6 congressional seats. I mention that only that I have heard people express the idea that it's a certainty that we will lose a seat next time. I would suggest it is not a certainty. It is perhaps a likelihood, but it is not a certainty that we will lose a seat in 10 years. We've seen this before, And Minnesota is about the only one of the Frost Belt states that has really kept its congressional apportionment for several decades. We have been at 8 seats since 1960. And everybody else has, except for the Dakotas, which only have one seat, so they can't lose anymore. Everybody else has pretty much declined in congressional representation, and in general, the Northeast and Midwest has declined in congressional and representation over the long period. This time around, Minnesota was literally the last seat to be apportioned. We knew it was going to be close, and the folks of Minnesota did a really great job in making sure that everyone filled out their census form. I believe that we were just about the best counted state in the country, and that was probably enough to push us over the top and allow us to beat out North Carolina at the finish line, and so we kept our 8 congressional seats, but it was really close. We knew it was going to be close, and it turned out to be very close. And here I'm turning to the concept of redistricting. With population growth over time and with a fixed number of legislative and congressional seats, those seats will get larger. This time, the average House district will increase by nearly 2,900 people this decade. The average Senate district will increase by about 5,700, and the average U.S. congressional seat will increase by about 48,000 people this decade. And with this table, you can see how that has changed over time since 1980, and the districts keep getting larger and larger in terms of number of people. And as you know, some districts within the state get physically much larger over time. As has been my practice now for 3 decades, towards the end of the decade, making estimates of congressional and legislative seats based upon the most current information we have for populations of the various areas of the state. This is designed mainly to give you an impression of what the likely changes will be. And when we get the actual data, hopefully within the next few weeks, that data will be slightly different. But I think this it'll show a very similar pattern. In congressional seats, the pattern was that the western and northwestern congressional district 7, the 2 central city districts, and the southern Minnesota district 1 are substantially grew at a substantially slower rate than the state average. Second and 6th congressional seats, the southern suburban and northern suburban districts grew at a substantially more rapid rate than the state population, and so we have a substantial inequality in congressional districts. If the legislature decides to keep the same general configuration of districts, which is your prerogative, the 6th congressional seat and the 2nd congressional seat would need to get substantially smaller to reach that equal population number. The 5th and the 4th would need to get substantially larger. The 1st district slightly smaller adjustment, but still a substantial adjustment. The 8th would also need to expand outward. The 3rd congressional seat is pretty close to the equal population size. The standard 10 years ago, and really for the last couple of apportionments, the standard for congressional districts is, to the extent practicable, absolute equality in population. Last time, they were different by one person, and that has been the standard that we've have attempted to achieve, and the standard apparently, as I understand it, that the courts require. Looking at Senate districts around the state, what we find is that the Senate districts in the particularly the Southwest, Northwest, and Northeast portions of the state are substantially smaller than the equal population level of population, while the suburban and exurban districts, particularly the districts in the Northwest suburban area, exurban area of Wright and Chisago counties, and also going up into Mille Lacs County, as well as the southern metro area in Dakota County, are substantially larger than the equal population size. And then we also have the central city districts are substantially smaller than the equal population size. The largest and smallest districts in the state, the smallest districts tend to be located in the Southwest and Northeast portions of the state, with district Senate District 20 being the smallest in the state. The largest districts tend to be in the suburban metropolitan area, in the South Metro, Northwest Metro, and up towards Mille Lacs, and there is now a substantial difference in population size of roughly 40,000 people, which is larger than a House district in size, between the largest and the smallest. And with that, I guess I better keep that up. With that, I will stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gillespie, on the, I guess your last several slides, the changes over the last 10 years, the population winners and losers, as it were, if you dialed it back 10 years, I mean, was essentially the last time we redistricted, were we looking at basically the same population shifts and dynamics in the same parts of the state? I'm just wondering if this is a bit of a, we've seen most of this dynamic before. Is that an accurate way to state it?
Mr. Chair, that is an accurate summary, that the general patterns are very consistent with history. The size over the last three redistricting is a little bit different. The magnitude of the differences was greater in the 1990 census, the 91 redistricting, where there was a substantial adjustment. The 2001 redistricting, the magnitude of the difference between the largest and smallest districts and variation was smaller. This time is between the two. It's not as quite an extreme situation as we saw in the 91 redistricting, but it's a little bit larger disparity than we saw in the 2001 redistricting.
And Mr. Gillespie, then more generally for members and staff here this morning, can you give us a little bit of your background as to what you've participated in several of these? What is kind of what kind of role would you like to play? What kind of role are you mandated to play, working with members and committee staff and otherwise, as we look forward to actually getting the census data, as you said, in the next couple of weeks here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my role has been I've been involved since the 1981 redistricting process. My role, as I see it, is very nonpartisan. That was a bit of a challenge 10 years ago when we actually had three parties represented in the process, and my particular boss at the time was heavily involved. Dean Barkley was heavily involved in the process, and so we need to keep a substantial arm's length relationship for during the year of redistricting. I do work as closely and cooperatively with the Legislative GIS Office in the Legislative Coordinating Commission, Mr. Miller. And I have worked together over a long period of time, and you know, my role is more in terms of making sure that the data is accurate, that any boundary changes, anything like that, has been reflected accurately and appropriately in the data, identifying what the trends are and the basic concepts and then also helping to coordinate the actual distribution and dissemination of the data, which is much less of an issue than it was back in 1980, where we had computer tapes and printouts, where we had to make sure they were all distributed simultaneously. This time, the Census Bureau takes care of much more of that. But certifying, helping Mr. Miller certify that the data is accurate and fair, and that everyone is using the same data and standing as a resource to your needs.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. There's been a little speculation in the press. I wonder if you have an opinion on this. Given the budget negotiations at the federal level and the potential for either a shutdown or, again, a lack of agreement between Congress and the administration on funding the government going forward, and that had a I think the date they're talking about is March 4th, that kind of this first week of March. Would that, in your understanding, could that, will that have any kind of impact on us getting the numbers and the figures in a timely fashion?
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding, and I'm still trying to get a final official word on this, but it is my understanding from the redistricting office, the reapportionment redistricting office in the Census Bureau, that a federal government shutdown would shut them down as well. And so they are moving as rapidly as possible. By the end of this week, they will be roughly at the halfway point of distribution of data. That's about where we expect to be, is somewhere around midway. So I'm expecting that we will hear about a release of data within the next week or two. If there were a shutdown in the federal government on March the 4th or 5th, that would create a difficulty in achieving that April 1st statutory deadline for the Census Bureau to disseminate all the data to all the states. So, yes, sir, that is my understanding. The news, I've been carefully watching the news, and the news seems to be a little more optimistic this morning. So I'm hoping that will not be a delay.
Well, and one follow-up on that then, Mr. Gillespie. So is it your understanding, do different states get this data at different times, or is it kind of all released en masse? Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, the data is distributed on an as completion basis. They are literally working on it as we speak, and so it's distributed on a flow basis. The priority ranking on the flow basis is related to the urgency, the shortness of the period with which the legislature must do the redistricting. Some states must finish before the end of their session this spring, finish the entire process, and they are the first ones that receive data. The end date for us is now less than a year away, February the 21st. Is that right, Mr. Bodden?
21st.
I believe it's approximately February, towards the end of February next year. So we are now a few days beyond. We have a few days less than a year left. That was moved up because of the moving up the primary. We basically lost a month in the redistricting process. Because of the change in the primary date. So there is a sense of urgency, but I don't know what the final rank. The Census Bureau does not do a pre-release of all the states and their ranking in terms of the distribution of the data, but they do distribute it on a on sort of an urgency need basis. Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Gillespie, so our urgency or need is we're a year out, and you're what you're stating is that there are other states that
two or three months
statutorily have given themselves less time to do that, and so they get that first they'd be first in line when it comes to the Census Bureau information.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Members, other questions of Mr. Gillespie at this time? Any info you want to get him going on? Mr. Bach, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gillespie, I think I understand why Florida's growing and why Arizona and maybe Nevada are growing with seniors moving down there, maybe moving out of the snow belt down there. But what's going on in Texas that they're growing so rapidly? Is that the snowbird effect, or is there something more than that going on there?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I'm originally from Texas, actually. I'm one of those that went the other way. You can get your...
You regret that?
You know, no, I don't, actually, Senator Bach. I do not regret that. And when I retire, I plan to stay here. Texas has enjoyed substantial benefit from resources, as well as substantial economic growth, as well as a Sun Belt migration destination, particularly in along the Rio Grande River Valley. The Gulf Coast area is an area that has received people over a period of time, and it just appears that some people like warmer Januaries than perhaps Minnesota can provide. A little bit of a note on Arizona, Florida, and Nevada. The growth that really matters for reapportionment is the growth over the entire decade. But the more recent trends, the trends in the last couple of years, seems to have been substantially altered. That some of the states, some of the most rapidly growing states, are also the ones that have had the biggest problems with foreclosures and with rising unemployment rates. And as a result, it appears that their growth has been substantially reduced. That there's even one estimate from Florida that Florida may actually have declined in population within the past couple of years. Nevada's growth has apparently substantially slowed. Now, they grew very, very rapidly over most of the decade, for about the first 7 years of the decade, and then that has been greatly slowed, if not actually reversed. So going forward, and that's why I would caution, assuming that we will lose a congressional seat going forward in 2020, that a lot can happen in a 10-year period of time, and the trends are not all positive in some of the states that have experienced rapid growth in the past. And in some cases, their growth now seems to be greatly altered. Similarly, in Georgia and South Carolina and some of the other states that have also experienced rapid growth.
Senator Bach.
Well, just for fun, Mr. Gillespie, can you put your crystal ball on and tell me? You and I are too old to be here 30, 35 years from now, but Senator Gerlach and Senator Michelle, they'll still be here. And
Senator's signing
off. I think he'll be here. Or Senator Rest. But as these baby boomers cycle through, what is going to happen to the whole Sun Belt?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, the Sun Belt effect, particularly for recent retirees, is mostly for people in their 60s and early 70s. And here, this refers to a permanent move, a permanent change of address. Most people, when they retire, do not move. They may spend a month or two someplace warm, but they don't actually change their address. And the vast majority of older people don't move. So my first crystal ball prediction is that migration is really going to slow down, that we will become a much less mobile society than we've been in the past. We may see people taking vacations, but we will become much less mobile. There are concerns about the financial basis for many of the people in the boom generation, that may not be as strong as previous retirees, and then that would also further reduce the mobility, because it tends to be the people that have resources who make long distance moves. We have in the past had a net outflow of people in their 60s and 70s. But that begins to reverse in the late 70s, and so that we have a net inflow normally of people in their late 70s and 80s and older. If overall migration slows, that would also tend to slow. Most migration tends to be, overwhelmingly, most migration tends to be young people. People in their 20s and 30s, they generally bring their children with them, and that over a long period, as the proportion of the total population that is represented in those age groups declines, I would expect overall migration rates to decline. In a normal year in Minnesota, we have between 75 and 80,000 people move into the state, and between 75 and 80,000 people move out of the state in terms of a permanent address change. The variables that are most closely related to that tend to be job market related variables, whereas the older population tends to be a much more consistent, sort of relatively modest-sized kind of flow, but it tends to be unidirectional. We tend not to get very many people retire and move to Minnesota. It tends to go the other way.
And Mr. Gillespie, so maybe just a bit of a follow-up to Senator Bach. So I've heard you and other committees talk about, I think this year or maybe last year was kind of the first year when the what we refer to as the baby boomers hit retirement age, and you correct me if I'm stating that wrong, but how long a cycle is that going to be? We have X number of years of that of baby boomers hitting that magical age.
Mr. Chair, the first members of the boom generation started turning 62 in 2008. They started turning 65 last month in January of this year. This decade we will see dramatic increases in the number of people 65 and older. The first big jumps in the both birth cohort, it was a modest jump for the people born in 1946, but a substantial jump in the number of people born in 1947 and 48. They turned 65 next year and a year after that. My expectation is that retirements will increase some this year, but very sharply next year and the year after that, and continue to be on an upward course, rising at a fairly substantial rate each year for about a decade and a half. So about the middle of next decade, we'll begin to see the number of retirees begin to slow down. But that'll be a sharp increase, and this will be the decade where we see the greatest change. The greatest changes we'll see this decade will be in the workforce and particularly in the number of retirees.
It's a 15-year dynamic.
Approximately a 15-year dynamic, yes, sir. The boom generation started in 1946 and ended, depending on how you want to measure it, somewhere around 62, 63. The peak year for Minnesota was 1958. In 1958, we had nearly 100,000 babies born. Now we're in sort of the mid 70,000 per year range.
Senator Gerlach, when were you born?
After you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, other questions or comments for Mr. Gillespie? Senator Senjum.
Well, I have to ask because Senator Gerlach didn't know. again, on the Minnesota population change, and maybe Senator Bach knows. And I'm not sure what county that is, way up in around Thunder Bay, but. But that's at least as red as Senator Laurie's district. Or I'm colorblind too, by the way.
Yes, you are.
Is it a growing, thriving county up there?
Senator Bach, you want to give the Rochester guy a little
Mr.
schooling?
Chairman, that's Cook County, and the biggest city in Cook County is Grand Marais at about 1,100 people. The entire county, I think. When I was first elected in the 90s, there were about 5,000 people in Cook County. I think there's 5,500. We'll see what there is in this census now. But the growth you see there is largely retirees, people moving up to Lake Superior to the Gunflint Trail, moving into the lake area. Much like you see, I'm sure that's the reason you see in the middle of the state, you see Crow Wing County, kind of pretty similar, and that's the Brainerd Lakes area.
And Senator Senjum, even given your color blindness, I think what I'd like to do is I'll ask staff and Mr. Gillespie if they can blow up this particular presentation so that each of these slides is a page, as large as a page as opposed to a quarter of a page, because it's pretty hard for us to, at our advanced years, to see that just for the packets, so we can... get a little better grasp of your presentation today. Members, we wanted to make sure we had Mr. Gillespie at the front end of our discussions. And Mr. Gillespie, thank you for coming in and for being available going forward. Unless there's any more thoughts or questions, members, we'll be adjourned. Thank you.
I know we got to meet again. No.